Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we are re-airing a conversation we had a couple of years ago with historian Mark Stein about the Stonewall Riot in New York City and other uprisings spearheaded by transgender, lesbian, gay, and bisexual people throughout the country in the late 1960s. Listening to it again, I found it a fascinating chat about the theory of revolution. Now, on the personal side, I do want to let you know that I'll be away for a few weeks as I try to recharge the battery, fill the enthusiasm tank, if you will. Now, our show will still be on at its regularly scheduled time. We'll have a mixture of some of our favorite shows from the past, some new shows that I've recorded and am getting ready for air, and some shows with guest hosts. I do want to urge you to stay with us. I suspect it will even be better than usual. Mark Stein is a professor of history at San Francisco State University. He joined us in the lead-up to the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riot, which occurred on June 28, 1969 in New York City. Mark Stein is the editor of the book, The Stonewall Riots, A Documentary History. Mark Stein, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station.
Thank you very much for having me.
So there is no one telling of the Stonewall Riots, is there?
Well, that's right. And as a historian, I would say that's the case for many great events in American history and in world history. So much depends on what kind of sources we consult, whose perspective we're trying to reach, and what our questions are, what our research questions are. So there have been questions about what exactly happened that night and that week during the riots, questions about who participated, why the riots happened, when and where they did, and then what were the impacts of the riots.
Is there a main narrative?
Well, I think there's general consensus on some core facts about what exactly happened. The police raided the Stonewall Inn in the early morning hours of June 28th. The Stonewall was a mafia-owned bar in Greenwich Village. Bar raids were common for LGBT commercial establishments, or I should say raids were common for LGBT commercial establishments, especially bars. And in the case of the Stonewall Inn and many other bars, there was a payoff system where organized crime owners and managers would pay off the police in order to reduce the frequency of bar raids. We don't exactly know why that system fell apart in late June 1969. There was a mayoral election that was taking place. Sometimes city officials, police officials cracked down on all different sorts of vice during election campaigns so that they could present themselves as morally pure and strong proponents of law and order. In any case, there are many different theories about why the police raided that night. It actually was the second raid on the Stonewall Inn that week. And then as the police arrested patrons, tried to take them into custody, a crowd gathered outside, began to fight back, began to attack the police. And then what ensued was several days of rioting in the streets of Greenwich Village.
According to everything we know, why did the police raid Stonewall?
Well, they advance several ideas about why that was happening. So, you know, many of the accounts, especially the ones from the LGBT and alternative press, emphasize the frequency of bar raids. Some of them do point to the political season, the election campaign. Some begin to broaden out to present larger perspectives. In developing the book, I was quite interested in one account that appeared in the Los Angeles Advocate, which at the time was a monthly Los Angeles-based newspaper. And the gay journalist, Don Jackson, he actually invoked a sociological theory about why revolutions happen. This doesn't really address why the police raided, but it does address why there was such an atypical reaction on the part of the patrons. And he invoked a theory that said revolutions happen not when conditions are at their worst and not when conditions are slowly improving, but rather when a period of improving conditions is followed by rapid reversals. And while he didn't really develop that notion very far in my introduction to this book, I try to fill in the gaps. And so to get back to your question, I think there was a series of reforms in the second half of the 1960s that correspond to improving conditions for LGBT people. And then there was an experience, I argue, of reversals in the months preceding the Stonewall Rebellion. And in that sense, we could think about the election of Richard Nixon in November 1968, the Revolutions International of 1968, and then the police crackdowns. So the country was beginning to turn more conservative. The sharp lines between left and right really were opening up, especially around the Vietnam War. So I do think we can see the police raid as part of a sense on the part of the police of increased support for law and order politics, increased support for cracking down on what they perceived as the liberalism of the Kennedy and Johnson years.
I want to know more about the mafia connection and the Stonewall. And could we say Stonewall, was it a gay club, gay and lesbian club? I know many transgendered people also went there. What kind of club was it, and why is the mafia involved in this?
The involvement of organized crime really varied by city. So in some cities, organized crime was very tightly involved with gay bars. In other cities, that was less the case. So that was less the case, actually, in California and in the Bay Area. But it was very definitely the case in New York and in Philadelphia. It was very difficult for LGBT people to own and manage bars. There were a lot of vulnerabilities associated with that. So on a certain level, organized crime, we could say, had the power to support these kinds of establishments and enough strength to withstand public opposition and police harassment.
Is it a business opportunity?
Exactly. And actually, this comes as a surprise to many people. It was a gay mafioso who was the principal owner of the four people who owned the bar. So we shouldn't necessarily think that just because they were mafiosos, they were not also gay. So yeah, they saw it as a business opportunity. They saw the gay market as a captive market, as a market that could be to some extent exploited with high prices, with watered down drinks, that a market that might put up with conditions that would not be acceptable to other communities. And so the mafia really owned, managed, controlled several dozen bars in New York City.
And it's only open for, a couple of years before this incident happens on June 28th, 1969.
Right. Exactly. And you asked earlier about then who frequented the bar, and there are conflicting accounts, actually, about that. And I think the most interesting accounts are the ones that we have from before the riots, because really every account that we have after the riots, it's influenced by what happened in late June 69. But the accounts beforehand we have are from gay bar guides. There were actually published gay bar guides that would direct people to the gay bars in different cities. And a couple of gay books that included descriptions of the bar. By all accounts, the night of the raid, there were about 200 people there. It was pretty packed. So the Stonewall was popular in part because it was fairly large. It was known for dancing, for drugs, for go-go boys. It's possible that today we would characterize it as a dive bar, or at least in my own early drinking days, I would have called it a dive bar, I think. By most accounts, the patrons were primarily gay, trans, genderqueer. There was a presence of lesbians that we know about from a good number of accounts. Class diversity. It was frequented by a good number of poor people, homeless people, street queens, people living on the streets, hustling. But it also seems to have appealed to more middle class.
This is an amazing scene. In your opinion, is this normal for what you call then, I guess, a gay bar? Or?
Gay bars were really diverse. So there were piano bars that might really appeal to an upper class clientele. There was a lot of racial racial segregation and racism in gay bars. So there was diversity in that respect. There were black gay bars in New York and in other cities. Interestingly, the Stonewall was not labeled as a black gay bar in the pre-riots gay guides, but we do know many accounts indicate that there was a significant presence of African Americans and Puerto Ricans in the bar, and including in the night of the raid and the riots themselves.
And you write in your introduction that you just couldn't walk in to the Stonewall Inn. They had to allow you in, and if you weren't perceived as being gay or transgender or lesbian, you weren't getting in.
That's right. And officially, the Stonewall Inn was what was called a bottle club. So it was not, it was essentially a private club, and you had to be a member to enter. The way bottle clubs officially were supposed to function, you would actually bring a bottle of liquor that you would place on reserve, essentially, and then the waiter would serve you your own alcohol, and this would be covered by the fees that you had paid as a member. Now, most accounts emphasize that that was a facade. The mafia preferred that kind of illegal arrangement because it was easier to circumvent liquor laws. But it was partly questions about that in some accounts led to the police raid, that there had been a violation of liquor licensing laws, of state liquor laws. That's part of the complicated story of what was going on as well.
What happens when the police enter?
So at first, undercover police entered the bar to do a kind of observation of what was going on, hoping to catch overt criminal activity. After a little while, they exit, connect with some other officers outside the bar. Then they go in and the raid begins. They sorted out who they wanted to take into custody or hold for further questioning and who they would allow to leave. It was typical in a situation like this for the police to single out trans people, people without identification, people of color. Bar managers and bartenders were often singled out, and anybody who talked back or fought back. So the police allowed most of the patrons to leave and kept others inside the bar. Well, it was the patrons who left who joined with people who were passing by. Word of mouth spread quickly, so a crowd gathered on the street. There are conflicting accounts about whether the police engaged in violence against the patrons who they kept inside. To some extent, there was also a checking of people's genders that was common in bar raids because of laws about cross-dressing that were in force. And in any case, as the police began to escort some of those they wanted to take into custody and arrest to police wagons that were waiting outside, the crowd began to erupt. There are conflicting accounts of the triggering moment, however things began to heat up, the crowd began to throw objects at the police, coins that in some accounts is meant to symbolize the corruption of paying off the police. Throw bricks, throw rocks. Eventually, the police retreated back into the bar. Some of the people who had been taken into custody were taken away in police wagons, but the remaining police were forced back into the bar. There was a uprooted parking meter used to try to break down the door. There was an effort to light the bar on fire. The police certainly, felt quite threatened. And just as in several accounts, the situation began to grow even more violent with the potential for the police to fire their weapons into the crowd, police reinforcements arrived and began to try to assert control. They did regain control of the Stonewall Inn itself, which was basically trashed inside and to some extent outside as well. But that began several nights of rioting by people in the streets of Greenwich Village. As the police tried to control the streets, crowds would gather, crowds would react, respond, begin chanting gay power slogans, directly challenging the police, and it really played out over the better part of a week.
For a week.
Yeah, apparently there were three nights when the rioting escalated. The first night, the second night, and then it grew quiet for a few nights, and then there was a third night of more significant rioting a few days later.
Was there anything that would bring this to constituent end? Did the city respond in a particular way? Does it, obviously it never truly died out, because it's still up to this day. You can argue the spirit's still moving, but this particular instance, was there something why did that come to an end?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's not clear why the rioting didn't continue. I think to some extent the gay protesters, the LGBT protesters, felt like they had made their point, and the weather intervened. That's apparently one of the reasons why things quieted down a bit. Also, the third night of rioting, many accounts emphasize that different people participated on that third night, more political activists rather than just ordinary people. They began to perceive what had happened as an opportunity. And
to organize.
Yeah, exactly. And that might have turned off some of the original rioters who thought that their experience was then being appropriated by outside agitators. But, you know, to some extent,
it also meant a controlled outlet. And now we have this, and now we're going to keep moving, but the rioting.
Yes, and so during that week, the Mattachine Society of New York, which was the main gay political group in the city, distributed flyers calling for a meeting, and so there may have been a sense that that would be the next place to decide what comes next, and it was really out of that meeting that emerged a new political group called the Gay Liberation Front, and the Gay Liberation Front then spawned dozens, hundreds, if not thousands of LGBT political formations and political organizations around the country in the next several years.
As this is happening in New York City, is it sparking similar type of events elsewhere?
Well, I think it did have that kind of effect. It wasn't immediate. I think many of my students are often surprised today to learn that the mainstream press did not cover the riots extensively. It was covered, kind of buried in the back pages of the New York Times, New York Post, New York Daily News. But national magazines like Time and Newsweek didn't cover the riots until October. So we have to situate ourselves 50 years ago. The internet didn't exist. Instant news didn't exist. So to some extent, it took a little bit of time for word to spread. But we do have accounts in the Bay Area of word quickly spreading out here through the telephone and through word of mouth. But the question of influence is complicated because if you were to ask some of the most radical gay activists in San Francisco in 1969 that question, they would say that the gay revolution had started in San Francisco several months before the Stonewall riots. So when one of the articles covering the Stonewall riots appeared in the Berkeley Barb, the reporter kind of congratulated the rioters for joining the revolution. He deliberately did not say beginning the revolution, and joining the revolution was the formulation because from his perspective and from the perspective of several dozen activists in the Bay Area, radicalization and mobilization had really begun in the Bay Area in about March 1969, several months before the riots.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation about the history, legacy, and different interpretations of the Stonewall riots, which marks its 50th anniversary on June 28th of this year. Our guest is Mark Stein. Mark Stein is the Jamie and Phyllis Pasker Professor of History at San Francisco State University. He's the author of a number of books, including Rethinking the Gay and Lesbian Movement, and he's also put together a book that he is the editor of, which is a collection of documents about the Stonewall Riots. It's called The Stonewall Riots, A Documentary History. Well, I'm glad you brought up San Francisco. It happened in March of 1969, just a couple of months before the Stonewall Riots. And we call it the Stonewall Riots. Some people will call it, whenever we use the word riots, rebellions or these things. There's sometimes the Stonewall Riots are seen as the birth of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights movement. But of course, there's a history before what happens to Stonewall.
Well, to begin the story a little bit earlier, most LGBT historians really are frustrated by the notion that everything began with the Stonewall riots and that there was no LGBT movement or even LGBT resistance before Stonewall.
Instead, and that's a common notion?
I think that's the common myth even today. We see that pretty much every year at the Pride parades, the Pride marches, that notion that the movement began with Stonewall. But most historians, I think, would agree that the movement really began in the early 1950s. There were a few efforts to agitate and organize even before then, but a sustained collective organized movement began in the early 1950s in California with the founding of first the Mattachine Society in Los Angeles, a group called the One Incorporated in Los Angeles also, and then the Daughters of Bilitis, a lesbian organization here in the Bay Area. By the mid-1960s, the movement had really changed, and so the Daughters of Bilitis still existed. It was a national organization with chapters around the country, but by the mid-60s, there were a larger number of groups, autonomous groups around the country, and things had begun to follow the pattern of civil rights morphing into black power, increased militancy, increased radicalization. So in the Bay Area, by the second half of the 60s, the main organization was called the Society for Individual Rights, and then the Daughters of Bilitis was continued to exist here. And then there was a very important organization called the Council on Religion and the Homosexual, which was really an alliance of the gay movement, gay and lesbian movement, with local ministers, local religious leaders. But by early 69, there was increased frustration with the strategies that the homophile movement, which was the name given to the pre-Stonewall movement, had been using. A frustration with the slow pace of change, dissatisfaction with the strategies of respectability that were in common use with picketing, demonstrations, and in the kinds of educational campaigns favored by the movement. Then a series of events happened in the Bay Area that really radicalized things. The main episode that led to the creation of a new organization here was the firing of an activist named Gail Whittington from a steamship company job. He was fired after a picture of him appeared in the Berkeley Barb, shirtless, being embraced by another man. And this was in an article, this was associated with an article about the gay movement. So he was openly declaring his homosexuality. And he then was immediately fired by the steamship company. Around the same time, a gay journalist named Leo Lawrence, who was writing many of those accounts in the Berkeley Barb, was fired from his job as the editor of the newsletter of the Society for Individual Rights. Why? Because he had begun using the newsletter to call for a gay revolution. So Lawrence and Whittington and a handful of other activists got together and established a new group, which they called the Committee for Homosexual Freedom. They began demonstrations in front of the steamship company in San Francisco. It was called State's Steamship Company. It was on California Street. And they began weekly and daily and then daily demonstrations. And this was covered in the local media. Around the same time, there were also a series of police killings of gay men. There was a particularly horrific one in Los Angeles. Howard Efland was killed by police during a raid on a gay hotel. The police claimed that he was resisting arrest. He was quite a small man. These big, beefy cops basically dropped him several times on the sidewalk by the accounts that we have, and he ended up dying. Shortly thereafter, here in Berkeley, Frank Bartley was killed by police. He was a gay man cruising in a popular cruising park in Berkeley, Aquatic Park, and police engaged in entrapment practices. So they would have an attractive cop appear in a well-known cruising area, and after allegedly some sexual propositioning occurred, though sometimes it didn't require that, the two policemen went to arrest Frank Bartley, and when he tried to escape, they shot him, and he died several days later. So this also
like
galvanized...
Merritt, too, right? Wasn't there?
Oh, well, then a little bit later...
in Oakland.
That's right. So there was a police, there was a killing in New York that also occurred. And then right before Stonewall, this I don't think was known at the moment of Stonewall because it really occurred just before the riots. But I do think it reflects the climate of the time. There was an apparently straight man, Philip Kaplan, who actually, by the media accounts, had a prostate problem, and so he peed frequently. He was playing with his daughter on Lake Merritt and went a few times to the bathroom. Police had the bathroom, the men's room, under surveillance, and they accused him of soliciting for sex in the bathroom and beat him up, and he ended up dying several days later.
Are all these cases you talk about, and granted, that last case you talked about at Lake Merritt in Oakland happened just before the Stonewall riots happened, so they may not have known about that in Greenwich Village, but all these other cases, are these big news? Are these cases that people are following, know about? Like, I mean, today's the internet world, so right. I'm sure it'd be a little bit different, but today when there's a police killing, there's a whole network of activists who know about it almost immediately.
Yes. Well, I found dozens of articles, media stories, about the killing in L.A. and the killing in Berkeley, and then later, dozens of articles about the killing in Oakland. Most of those media accounts were in the California press, mainstream, alternative, and LGBT. But if we want to provide a link to the Stonewall riots, the Mattachine Society of New York had a newsletter, and shortly before the Stonewall riots, it reported on the two earlier killings in California, in Los Angeles, and in Berkeley, and then a recent killing in New York right near the Stonewall Inn.
So they would report on those kind of things.
Yeah,
now, and is everyone reading that?
Well, that's the good question. And there's no smoking gun that allows us to say we don't have a rioter saying I was upset about the police killings and that's why I responded the way that I did. But the Mattachine Society's newsletter did have hundreds, if not thousands, of subscribers. We know that the leaders and the members of those organizations went to gay bars. There would likely have been word of mouth. Another factor that was going on in New York was Mayor Lindsay, Mayor John Lindsay, a somewhat liberal Republican, was running for re-election. And just before the Stonewall riots, he was defeated in the Republican primary by a much more conservative candidate. And the Democratic candidate was also much more conservative. And Lindsay had been known as a friend of the gay community in the last few years of the 1960s. Now, he would be criticized in the 70s for not moving fast enough, but he had agreed to reduce police entrapment practices in New York, reduce the enforcement of sexual solicitation laws. So he had a somewhat positive reputation among at least some gay activists and gay leaders, but he was defeated. So I think the LGBT community in New York would have been aware, I think, of these police killings, would have been aware that political winds were changing. Nixon had been elected. One of the things I realized in thinking about Nixon's election, this was the first time in decades that New York City residents had a Republican mayor, governor, and president after Nixon's election. And the interesting thing is that Lindsay went on to run on a third-party ticket, and so he actually retained his position as mayor. But the rioters couldn't have known that. From their perspective, they were losing a relatively gay-friendly mayor, facing the prospect of a much more conservative mayor who was more aligned with Nixon's law and order politics. And I think that also contributed to the mood in the bar.
People just had enough.
I think that's right. And that's what takes me back to that theory about revolutions happening when there's been a period of improving conditions followed by quick reversals. Right, right. Yeah. And so, I've mentioned some of the reforms that happened in the second half of the 60s. And another one was a relaxation of the city's ban on hiring quote-unquote homosexuals in city government jobs. I also earlier didn't mention that there had been some court rulings that reduced the scope of police raids and police closures of gay bars. So there had been this sense of improvement. Connecticut became the second state to eliminate its sodomy law. So a sense of that if a neighboring state from New York could do that, why couldn't New York? West Germany, Canada, and Great Britain all partially decriminalized sodomy in the lead up to the Stonewall riots. So there was this perception of improving conditions. And then, as we've been talking about, there were the developments in politics, in electoral politics, that seemed to suggest changing winds and more repression and more police crackdowns on the way. And there were these police killings, and there were other more negative developments that I think end up just aligning with that theory about why people might respond more aggressively and more aggressively and more strongly, you know, at the moment of Stonewall.
And the repression's intense. You already mentioned the surveillance of bathrooms. You mentioned many of these groups, these rights groups, began in the 1950s. And it's important to understand the repression that was happening, I guess, in the 1950s. And maybe this is the lowest point of that repression, because the repression towards gay and lesbian transgender folks was very much tied in to the Cold War and the Red Scare.
That's right. And there's a great new documentary film just out on the Lavender Scare. It's based on the work of historian David Johnson, and it really showcases the heights of repression in the 1950s, which involved police crackdowns, but also federal government, state government, local government, passing new laws against LGBT people, and that took a lot of different forms. It took the form of obscenity crackdowns. It took the form of immigration restriction. It took the form of bans on LGBT people in the military and in civil service jobs. Those had existed before, but there was a heightening of many of those restrictions in the 1950s. I think the situation had somewhat changed by the 60s. After all, this was a period of liberal reform under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. We find in general the...
For gay and lesbian transgender folks in those administrations, or...
That's a good question, and it's complicated, and I think we need to do more research to figure out what the story was with respect to those kinds of patterns. I think there was a combination of ongoing repression, but also some signs of loosening up. I think that's the way that I would characterize it. And I should also emphasize that the levels of repression very much depended on which of those letters of the alphabet we're talking about, LGBT or other parts of the queer and trans communities. And so... I think in many respects, there was ongoing repression for trans people, ongoing repression for queers of color, ongoing repression for homeless people, poor people, immigrants, right? And
trans people, they're center at the Stonewall.
That's right. And we know, I think the preponderance of evidence suggests that trans people probably weren't a majority of those rioting, but they played it is quite clear from the sources that they played a leadership role in fighting back, in initiating the strongest responses, in sustaining the energy and momentum. That I think is the consensus of the sources, whether we are talking about the documentary sources or later oral histories. Some people would say that they had little to lose. I'm not sure that's a fair way to characterize things, because everybody had a lot to lose in a situation of a police raid. But they did have a great deal of courage, often campy courage in the context of the riots. But a great deal of courage in fighting back, and for decades they had been the public's representative of the gay community. One of the things that I think is really interesting and complicated about reading our sources from the Stonewall era is we'll read references to gay men or to gay youth or to homosexuals, and today many readers might think that means people who are gay in terms of their same-sex sexual orientation. But I think if we really look at those sources carefully, homosexual or gay was used in much more capacious ways then as compared to now. So in many of the accounts, homosexual would have included trans people. Mm-hmm. Gay would have included trans people. Gay would have included lesbians. And we have to be quite careful about imposing our identity categories and our impulses to police the boundaries between all these identities on this moment 50 years ago when things were configured differently.
And as a historian, you're walking that line.
Exactly. I think, you know, we're trained to do that kind of reading of sources. And one of the reasons I decided to orient my book to documentary sources is that I think today a lot of people rely primarily on oral histories of the Stonewall riots. And I think they are incredibly valuable, interesting material. But I think it's really time to go back to the accounts from 1969.
And you're looking at a lot of press reports.
That's right.
From the Berkeley Barb and sort of these public type of publications.
Yeah, as well as LGBT media accounts. Yeah. So, of the 200 documents in the book, probably about 150 are from the press. My book, though, does include demonstration flyers, a few excerpts from court decisions, a few excerpts from gay bar guides. That provides further context. But all of those sources are from 1965 to 1973.
Well, let me come back to California. And I appreciated you laying out all the things that occurred before what happened in Stonewall. But I want to go back to March 1969, San Francisco, 2 months before Stonewall. What happened?
Well, so the Committee for Homosexual Freedom began staging a series of demonstrations. They demonstrated against the firing of Gail Whittington. They demonstrated here in Berkeley after the killing of Frank Bartley, and that was a demonstration in alliance with the Society for Individual Rights. They started participating in what was called disorientation at UC Berkeley that was immediately after Stonewall in the fall semester. But in the months leading up to Stonewall, they worked to forge alliances with the Black Panthers. They were very interested in what's sometimes called the movement of movements.
And the Black Panthers were open?
They were increasingly open. So it was around this time, actually, that Huey Newton issued a now quite well-known letter that addressed the relationship of the Black liberation movement to women's liberation and to gay liberation. And Newton called for an alliance, called for an opening, called for coalition building. And the Panthers in 1970 organized what they called the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention, the first session of which was held in Philadelphia. There was a male homosexual workshop. There was a lesbian workshop. The workshops delivered statements to the thousands of people who gathered at the convention. So there was a real sense that this was an important moment for movements to form alliances, coalitions. And again, the Vietnam War was escalating. And that really, I think, maybe more than anything, served as a rallying issue for movements to come together.
In San Francisco, does it have its own riot?
Earlier in San Francisco, in 1966, there had been what's called the Compton's Cafeteria Riot. So in the pre-Stonewall era, there had been several dozen demonstrations. I mentioned before the Committee for Homosexual Freedom demonstrations in 69. But there were demonstrations earlier, a few demonstrations in L.A. After police raids on gay bars, more respectable demonstrations on Armed Forces Day to protest exclusion from the military that happened in various California cities, demonstrations at Grace Cathedral to protest anti-gay actions by Christian churches. But in addition, there were demonstrations and a riot, Compton's Cafeteria, to protest denials of service by businesses. And that was one instance of that, and we know of several others. And the flavor of that demonstration was really quite different from the flavor of the respectable demonstrations on Armed Forces Day and and in some other contexts. But leading up to Stonewall, the Committee for Homosexual Freedom, sometimes in alliance with Society for Individual Rights, organized demonstrations. They participated in United Farm Worker, great boycott demonstrations at Safeway stores, and things were really kind of building. And then Stonewall happened. And I think that really galvanized the movement in San Francisco. But I think folks in the Bay Area really interpreted Stonewall through the prism of what had been happening recently in California. And so principally, they interpreted it as yet another instance of police repression and yet another demonstration of the importance of strong LGBT responses to that police repression. So for the next several months after Stonewall, if we're going to move into the post-Stonewall era, the Committee for Homosexual Freedom continued to be the leading organization. They continued to demonstrate. One of the more significant actions happened in the fall of 69 when they protested at the offices of the San Francisco Examiner, which had published a quite anti-gay feature story. And at that moment, there were really a series of protests around the country against mainstream media. So the Gay Liberation Front had done a protest at the Village Voice in New York. Los Angeles, there was a protest against the Los Angeles Times. There was a major protest in New York at Harper's Magazine. But here in San Francisco, there was this major protest at the San Francisco Examiner. It involved the Committee for Homosexual Freedom and a new organization that had emerged, the Gay Liberation Front, modeling itself on the organization in New York. That's the closest, I would say, to San Francisco having a riot in the aftermath of the Stonewall riots, because what happened as this demonstration was occurring outside the offices of the Examiner, apparently two staffers dropped a bag of purple ink, printer's ink, from the second floor or the roof, it's unclear which, on the demonstrators below. So they ended up covered in purple ink. And the protesters, rather than just going home to clean up, began making imprints of their hands on the building and on surrounding buildings, and using the purple ink to write on the buildings, write gay power slogans on the building. It went down in history as the Purple Hands protest, or the Night of the Purple Hands. The protest line began to be much more militant. Police ended up violently responding to the protesters, taking several of the protesters into custody. As the protesters regrouped, they ended up marching to City Hall and conducted a sit-in in the mayor's office in City Hall. So this really turned into quite a media event, as well as a galvanizing event for the local LGBT movement.
Wow. The Night of the Purple Hands?
Yes. And the Purple Hands, we actually continue to see as a symbol for several years. Obviously, other symbols have become more popular. But, you know, when San Francisco had a quite small commemoration of the Stonewall riots a year later, San Francisco didn't have a major commemoration until a few years later. L.A. had a major commemoration in 1970, along with New York and Chicago. But the small one that happened in San Francisco in the summer of 1970 used the Purple Hands as one of the visual images for the flyers that were used to promote the event to commemorate Stonewall.
So people begin commemorating the anniversary of Stonewall the very next year. Does it ever fall out of favor or popular imagination?
Not really. I think many of us believe that while Stonewall itself was important, what really launched a new stage in LGBT history was what happened afterwards. And I think about that in three ways. There was a mass mobilization, political radicalization, and social diversification of the LGBT movement. With respect to the commemoration, there had been annual marches in front of Independence Hall on July 4th in Philadelphia from 1965 through 1969. Those are known today as the annual reminders. Of course, the first one wasn't the annual reminder, but when it was repeated in 66, it became the annual reminder. The fifth of the annual reminders took place just days after the Stonewall riots. Well, several months later, there was a regional LGBT movement meeting in Philadelphia. And it was at that meeting that there was a proposal to discontinue the annual reminders at Independence Hall on July 4th and to replace them with Christopher Street Liberation Day, which became Gay Pride. And the initial proposal was that the commemoration should center in New York, but that other cities were encouraged to organize their own events. In that first year, Chicago and Los Angeles took up the call to do so, but that conference that took place in Philadelphia agreed to end the annual reminders and start the annual commemorations. So we now have, I guess it's now 49 years of gay pride parades, protests, marches, you know, that began in 1970 and that obviously spread initially from just a handful of cities to the point today where now probably hundreds of cities in the United States, as well as a good number of places around the world, commemorate the Stonewall riots.
Christopher Street, this is the street that Stonewall Inn was on.
Exactly, exactly. Hence, Christopher Street Liberation Day. And initially, the events in California were called Christopher Street West.
Christopher Street West,
yes,
that's what we called it.
Yes, yeah. So the first Los Angeles Pride Parade, that's the name that it used. We didn't have a major protest, march, parade in San Francisco until 1972. Maybe that reflects the fact that San Francisco and people in the Bay Area thought that the revolution had started here in the Bay Area, so why necessarily raise up Stonewall to such singular importance? If that was the reason that nothing much happened in 1771, it was kind of a losing battle because the commemoration really became central to how LGBT people commemorate their history, right? And the riots became central to the way that LGBT people narrate their own history. Unfortunately, it leads to some myth-making, you know, as we were talking about before, that notion that the movement began at Stonewall, but it does provide us with an annual opportunity to revisit that moment and to revisit the larger history of LGBT struggles.
And here we are having this conversation, marking the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. And I guess how people, you point out in your introduction, I think we talked about, people have different interpretations of even what happened at Stonewall, never mind its legacy here later. Here we are 50 years later. What are your thoughts? And, you know, one thing I hear, and we're at KPFA, sort of a lefty radio station. I'll hear, and when we talk about the advancements that we've seen, important strides made by LGBT rights movement, same-gender marriage is now legal, and people are joining the military, and I hear critiques about that, about this isn't what Stonewall was supposed to be about, getting into the military and then marrying in order to be more part of society, mainstream society.
Right, we really do see that conflict today, and the last chapter of my book includes documents from the first 4 years of Stonewall commemorations, pride parades, protests, marches, and I think it's really quite interesting to see that many of the conflicts we see today about how we should commemorate Stonewall began in 1970, 71, 72, and 73. So there were certainly conflicts about the different groups that make up the queer rainbow. So lesbian concerns about marginalization and invisibility, trans concerns along similar lines, trans and lesbian conflicts. There were disputes early on that we see echoed today about business involvement, corporate sponsorship, police involvement, state government involvement, the presence of elected officials, all of that, all of that was controversial right from the start.
Right from the get-go, from the first commemoration.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there, the issue might have been, should bars be prominent in the marches, and should and the struggles with the police consisted of, at least in Los Angeles, there was even a struggle to get a police permit, where the police wanted to deny a permit for the parade. That takes us through the next five decades of conflicts about how to commemorate Stonewall. And in my own experience, I first started going to Pride parades in Boston in the 1980s and have now been to many in Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Toronto, and San Francisco. I think the politicization of Pride has really ebbed and flowed. I think there were years in the 1980s at the height of the first decade of the AIDS epidemic where there was a repoliticization of pride.
Yeah.
So I would say that, there was a politicization in the first few years. There was a repoliticization in the late 70s, the era of the Briggs Initiative here in California, Harvey Milk's moment, the Save Our Children campaign in Florida, the real moment of heightened moment of conservative backlash. Repoliticization in the second half of 80s because of AIDS. Repoliticization in the 90s when the group Queer Nation emerged. And I think we're seeing some of that energy today with calls for repoliticizing pride. And I think while in the broadest sense, people want to just celebrate LGBT rights, LGBT inclusion, LGBT acceptance, I think it's really important to recognize that the riots happened because of police aggression, police violence, state regulations, state control, and the response was militant, radical, aggressive, and even to the point of being violent. The riots also were triggered by business practices, capitalist exploitation. And so I think for today's LGBT radicals, just as you put it, you know, we should not be fighting for same-sex marriage. We should not be prioritizing military inclusion. We should be wrestling with questions about state violence, police violence. We should be focusing on the more marginalized members of the larger LGBTQ community, and that means prioritizing issues about issues of concern for trans people, for people of color, for immigrants. And that's why I think today's radical really want a reorientation of pride away from corporate participation, the political messages of acceptance on mainstream society's terms, right? And so I think we're seeing some of that politicization even as we celebrate the 50th.
Of course. Mark Stein is a professor of history at the at San Francisco State University. He is the editor of a book, The Stonewall Riots, a documentary history. Mark Stein, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you very much.